may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, sir. May it please the court, I'm Richard Locke and I represent Carol Montgomery. In March of 2011, the court entered a final divorce decree awarding spousal support of $4,100 and child support of $1,123 to Ms. Montgomery. In 2014, the husband filed a motion to amend, alleging that she had inherited certain property and did not need the support any longer. There was a three-day Horry Tennis hearing held in 2016. At the conclusion of that, the court found that wife's income had increased, there had been little or no changes in her expenses, and he terminated spousal support. We filed this appeal alleging several errors. The first two really relate to real estate that Ms. Montgomery had inherited. She, along with her brother, inherited three pieces of real estate. One was the family's historic vacation home in Deltaville, they called Rope Yarn, and then her parents' residence in Enrico County.
You've got a lot of ground to cover, so I'm going to try to help you as best I can cover most of the ground. Are you suggesting that the trial court did not consider the statutory factors to make a determination on spousal support?
Well, what I'm suggesting is he didn't consider all the statutory factors, in particular with respect to him considering rental income from the inherited properties. He assumed that the properties could be rented and should be rented and imputed income to rental income when the evidence was uncontradicted that the properties could not be rented. Both Ms. Montgomery and her brother testified that they were not willing to rent or sell it, but in particular her brother, who was a co-tenant of the property, testified he was unwilling to rent the property. So the property could not be rented, and the judge imputed rental income despite that. So that was their first assignment of error.
His unwillingness to rent it, the same thing is not rentable?
Well, whether my client was willing to rent it or not, her brother was a co-owner of the property and was unwilling to rent it. So she could not force the rental of the property.
I think you're actually misstating the facts a little bit here. As I understand the record, they were the beneficiaries of a trust here. The trust is actually the owner of the properties involved. They were both the trustees and the beneficiaries. She and her brother were both the trustees and the beneficiaries. And as I understand it, at the time of this hearing, the assets of the trust had not been distributed.
I think that's correct. The Rosendorf, when the parents died, they left the property in the Rosendorf family
so
trust.
To describe her as inheriting this property, I think, is somewhat inaccurate because they didn't hold title to it. In fact, her brother had just as much, you know, property interest as she did in the properties as co-trustees. So
that's correct. But the trust, once her parents died, limited their responsibilities to distributing the assets to the two of them. So I think it
didn't control when or
that's correct.
They had a lot of I think you'd have to agree they had a lot of latitude under the terms of the trust. And at the time of this hearing, they were not the title owners.
That's correct. It was still owned by the trust, but their sole responsibility at the death of their parents was ultimately to transfer the assets to the two of themselves. So you're correct that they didn't own the property.
I think that probably helps your argument.
It does. And we raised that argument in our brief that she didn't in fact own it at the time of the hearing. It was still owned by the trust.
It was the trust agreement said that it was to be distributed equally to brother and sister.
Correct.
But didn't say by when.
Correct.
Did it say when it was distributed, the real estate, the two pieces of real estate that were potentially rentable, did it say that they were to own them as tenants in common or joint tenants with rights?
I do not think the trust specifically specified how they would hold title to the property. It said that the assets of the trust would be equally divided between their two children. So our first assignment is that it wasn't rentable either because she didn't own it at the time of the hearing, or if ultimately it's distributed to her, she co-owns it with her brother who's unwilling to rent it. And his testimony is in page 576 of the appendix where he indicated he was unwilling to rent it. But even if for whatever reason the court were to conclude that it was capable of being rented, the second assignment of error that we raised was that the court did not include the expenses associated with the rental property. The court accepted the testimony of husband's expert that it could be rented and that her share of the rent would be $1,975, but completely ignored the undisputed testimony from the wife that there were expenses associated with maintaining this property. In fact, she testified in the last three pages of the appendix, there are three income and expense statements. One of them, the next to the last one, deals with what the expenses of maintaining this property is if they did not rent it, and then another income and expense statement if they rented the property. The expenses associated with maintaining this property if they rented it were $2,246 a month. It exceeded the rental income that the court imputed to her. So our second...
But didn't the court struggle with the lack of evidence to support it as opposed to her statement that this is what it's going to be? Obviously, the court could consider that, but was there any documentation to support this idea that there were going to be these exorbitant expenses associated with maintaining more property?
I don't think there was anything in the record that indicated the court struggled with it. The court simply stated in its letter opinion that it wasn't going to consider the expenses associated with their inherited property. The expenses included real estate taxes, homeowners insurance, and property management fees if they were to rent it. So there was no dispute at trial raised as to the legitimacy of those expenses. In fact, some of them, she testified to them. So that wasn't the reason the court didn't consider the expenses. He simply said he wasn't going to hold husband responsible for her expenses.
Let me take it to another point, and I'm sure we're going to hear about this from your opponent colleague, is that if we were to agree with you, wouldn't it set up a circumstance where a party comes into an inheritance, and because of the way the inheritance is titled, can foreclose at being considered as part of their income in perpetuity, but just sitting on the property and thereby saying, I can't do anything with it, so it cannot be subject to any inquiry by the court as far as assessing my financial needs?
Well, I think it depends on how it's inherited. For example, if the parents had left it to her with a life estate to pass on to her children, there would be examples where she could not rent it. You may inherit a family portrait that has some value, but you're not required to sell that asset to create income. But even if the court were to say that she was required to rent it, this case has decided in a number of cases, including the three that we cited in their brief, that you have to consider the expenses associated with arriving at that rental income. And the court here completely ignored those, even though there was no controversy about the expenses.
And the case that you're making reference to are Dega, Barnes, and Rowe.
Correct. And Dega was a case where the gentleman had received $40,000 a year in rental income, and the court did not include in its consideration of support the mortgage payment that he was making on that, which included, I think, escrows for homeowners and property taxes, and the court reversed.
You're not arguing this, just to clarify, with regard to any of the other property that she inherited, the income ability to be drawn, for example, from the stocks and bonds, that sort of thing.
That's correct. She inherited $817,000 of cash and securities, and the court properly applied a 2.7% return to those cash and securities to determine what her income was from that inherited
property.
You're not
arguing that.
I'm not arguing that was improper.
Can I ask you on an assignment of error that Mr. Montgomery lists, and that is that the spousal support, I believe I'm saying, support was argued, was decided wrongly because spousal support was not excluded from his income and included in her income.
Well, as you saw in our reply brief, we didn't respond to that because I think that is one of at least five errors the judge made, that one plus the four that we have raised. The statute requires...
So there's a whole lot of things that need to be fixed in your view.
Yeah, well, that point that they raised, I think, is legitimate. You have to deduct from the payor's obligation spousal support, and you have to include it in the recipient for child support. So I think he's right about that. We didn't argue in that brief that he wasn't right about that point.
Thank you.
So the third issue we raised related to the court's imputation of income to her from employment. They called an expert, a vocational expert, Peter Melberg, who testified. The entire operating assumption of his testimony was that she went back to work in 2011 and received periodic raises over those 5 years. Neither one of those facts were accurate. So his entire opinion was based on a faulty assumption.
So he said her imputed income, for lack of a better way of putting it, at $65,000.
Correct.
And your point is that, well, first, she didn't earn it. She wasn't working during that time. And so, therefore, to impute income at a rate with a 2.7% return is incorrect as a matter of law.
Well, I think the 2.7% return was the rate of return on inherited assets. The court ultimately didn't take exactly Melberg's opinion, but adopted his philosophy that She essentially treated the 2011 imputation order as an order to go to work, and said that had you gone to work as the court, paraphrasing, had you gone to work as the court told you you should have done in 2011, you would have gotten periodic raises. So I'm taking the imputed income from 2011, applying some raises to that, and that's what I'm using as your income.
It actually came with a $65,000 figure, then offset it by $5,000 or something.
Yes, I'm not exactly sure how the court came up with the calculation of the number he actually used, but our point is that the entire assumption that their expert used and the court ultimately did was essentially assuming that the 2011 imputation order was an order to go to work. The court can certainly impute income to a party if they are voluntarily underemployed, but the court can't order someone to go to work. And in evaluating this case in 2016, the court had to look at the current circumstances of the parties. And
what income level do you suggest that the court, if it were indeed deciding to impute income, should have imputed income at the level of?
Well, so there were only two experts who testified. Dr. Melberg's was based on the assumption she went to work in 2011 and got raises. The only other expert was Larry Sensabaugh, who testified based on the fact that she'd been out of the workforce for 20 years, that she
regenerated and have to go to school,
right,
and all
that. And
that
she would make about, I think his testimony was approximately $29,000. So I think there certainly would have been justification for that. But that there were only two experts who testified on her income.
The review says that if the trial court considers the testimony of expert witnesses, it can pretty much pick and choose which expert he or she wants,
right,
to believe.
Unless the testimony of one expert is based on a faulty assumption, and that makes the admissibility of that expert testimony.
Let me ask you on that. Why is it a faulty assumption? Now, the parties agreed that she would stay home and look after the children, and he would work and bring in the income. So, but putting that aspect aside for a moment, if the court decided to impute income in 2011,
correct,
and the court decided, you know, then has to re-decide what the imputed income should be, why shouldn't the court, putting aside the fact that they agreed on this for years, why shouldn't the court say, well, she didn't do it, so I'm not going to just put it right where it was before. If she had been working, she would be making more money by now.
Well, because if you do that, you're effectively treating the imputation orders in order to go to work. And that's not what it is, nor is it what it can be.
I don't know that I would agree with you. I think Judge Beals put his finger on the point. I mean, and I haven't, you know, there's an ancient equitable doctrine called latches. You know, the 2011 order originally imputing her income of $3,500, I believe, a year, was never contested. You know, and so it is what it is, you know, and she can't now go back, it seems to me, and complain about that. So the only remaining issue is there any error in the court essentially saying, okay, you're in the same situation you were then, but you're still not working, which is fine, but you could have earned $5,000 a year now based on, you know, the raises you would have gotten had you gone to work, and that's essentially what the court did. Why is that error?
Well, because she's not in the same situation she was in 2011. She was more employable in 2011 than she was in 2016. So the court has to evaluate her current employability once the change in circumstances has been demonstrated based on her current ability to get a job.
But then the alter ego of that is that she failed to maintain the status quo. She was employable then. She now has become, in your view, unemployable. So she should be rewarded for that.
Well, not unemployable. Employable at a lower rate than she was in 2011. I mean, expert conceded that she was employable at the income amount of approximately $29,000. So we don't contend she was unemployable, but they were.
Just want to let you know, I've allowed you to go into your. We've had a lot of questions for you, so finish your answer. I just want to.
We're not arguing she was unemployable. Simply that she was employable at a lower rate than she was in 2011, and the court has to base it on the current circumstances.
I'll give you your 3 minutes that you requested because we've had loads of questions.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Harris. I represent Appellee John Montgomery.
Here, let's just settle in before we jump you, so we can sort of get this thing.
Yes, sir.
It appears that there's a concession that there was an error by the trial court by not considering the spousal support income. So I don't really think you need to deal with that issue. The one that jumps out at me, at least initially, is the failure of the trial court to offset expenses related to the one property in its calculation as to what the assets of your client.
Well, in fact, Your Honor, thank you for asking that question. Your Honor, in fact, Ms. Montgomery did testify that she had certain expenses, including, for example, storage of the property in these properties. Her parents, who were deceased, the storage of these properties. And this whole issue goes back to the issue of what the trust requires. Your Honor asked, is there any deadline on the disposition of this asset? The trust agreement doesn't provide a deadline.
Well, the trust, I mean, you know, it's been a while, and we don't do a lot of trust work. You know,
yes, sir.
We'll trust the state work in
yes,
the
sir.
Court. But a trust is a recognized legal entity. It's, you know, everybody's referring to this property as her inherited property, and maybe it is de facto, but it is not de jure. It is the property of this entity called the trust. She's a beneficiary, and if and when the property is distributed to the beneficiary, then obviously then it becomes her property, and that has legal consequences. But it seems to me until that occurs, it's error, or at least arguably error, for the trial court to treat it as if this trust just didn't exist.
And let me raise one more salient material fact from your pattern that you didn't bring up. She not only is a beneficiary with her brother, Michael Rosendorf, but she's also a co-trustee.
And as I mentioned that earlier.
And as a co-trustee, she is charged with a fiduciary duty to exercise the terms of the trust as dictated by the trustors, her parents.
And the trust agreement gives her a tremendous amount of latitude, and I'll quote you from what I think is the important part of it here, if I can lay my hand on it quickly.
I would lay my hands on part D, Your Honor, but I'll let you lay your hands on what you think is a material issue.
So, well, I was looking to tell us about part D that you think is important.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. The trust provides subpart D that upon the disposition at the death of both trustors, any assets remaining in the trust shall be distributed as follows. It doesn't have a time limit, but it says shall be distributed as follows. Equally divided between our children, Michael Rosendorf per Surpeace and Carol Montgomery per Surpeace. And in fact, the actions in terms of the trustees and slash beneficiaries' conduct pursuant to the demise of her parents bears and is telling here. In fact, they did divide.
Let me interrupt you because, in part, first of all, what you referred to has not been litigated, as near as I can understand. The issue of whether the trust boards are carrying out their fiduciary duty has not been litigated. But the trust agreement, and this is under the retention of investments section, says the trustors authorize the trustee to retain any such assets received from either of us or our estates for as long as the trustee may deem appropriate. Whether or not such assets satisfy the prudent investor standard for fiduciary investments, produce some income, or represent an over-concentration of one investment. It seems to me I don't know how you get much more broad than that in investing the trustees with complete discretion as to how, when, and, you know, whatever for disposing of the assets.
But Your Honor, I agree to that, but as it relates to the triggering of the disposition of the asset upon the death of the trustors, they shall divide the property equally. They are the trustees during the lifetime of these parents.
That's not unusual in trust agreements, is it, Mr. Harris? Because often you have a trust that's allowing the children to maintain it as a trust or to distribute it, but then when they die, the trust has to have an end at some point, and it's to make sure that no children, grandchildren, are left out, it's distributed for stirpes.
That is correct. There is not a definite date of demise here, but there is a definite date in terms of disposition upon the death of these parents. And in this case, the trustors, the parents, did give to these trustees their children that latitude Your Honor is describing. But upon their death, these trustors also provided what would be the disposition of the assets remaining in the estate. It did not give.
My simple point is that, irrespective of whether the trustees here have done what the trust contemplates or not done, or honored a fiduciary duty or not honored a fiduciary duty, at the point in time when a hearing is held in the circuit court, these assets have not been distributed. They are not the assets of the wife here in her capacity as you know, the daughter of the trustor.
That's correct.
She is only a trustee and a potential beneficiary at the point in time when the trust is dissolved and the assets distributed. So,
yes, sir.
How does the, you know, I'm troubled by the fact that court treated this as if that trust just didn't exist. It was not, you know, not recognized in any way, shape, or form as the entity that the law recognizes the trust to be.
Well, I don't think the court disregarded the trust itself. In fact, the trust is in the record. The deeds conveying the property to the trust are in the record. What the court did, however, is it decided that between 2011, June of 2011 was the latter parent's death, and 2016, when this case was adjudicated in full by September of last year, that 5 years implicitly was sufficient time for these trustees to exercise their fiduciary duties under subparagraph D to divide the assets equally. And conveniently, they did so as it relates to the liquid assets, the investment assets. They did that pretty promptly, yielding $817,000 in liquid assets. What they decided to do is that whether Mr. Rosendorf elected, I don't want to rent it, I don't want to sell it, that was their choice. The court, in fact, Your Honor, in the case called Brower versus Brower, the court noted, and that's a Virginia Supreme Court case, 215 Virginia 62, the person, and this is the case of the payor, important, it's not an important distinction, but it's each party's obligation to raise as much money. The payor had an estate devised to him by his mother. It was a life estate. It was not in fee simple. But the court there said that the payor, that is the husband, who had said he didn't have enough income, the court noted that he and the trustee, the executor of the estate, the fiduciary duty, quote, appeared to have not been aggressive in achieving the maximum income which the estate could produce. Had appellant so exercised, he could have obtained construction of his mother's will or attempted or other action in order to increase his income. That case stands for the proposition that an asset may not be income producing. For example, Mr. Locke used the illustration of a portrait. You don't have a duty to sell a portrait. Well, I don't know portrait, car, real estate. I do know that it's an asset generally, that the Virginia Supreme Court and this court has echoed that same sentiment in a case styled LAS versus SAS, LCS versus SAS. I'll give you the citation in a moment, that the payor or the payee, as the case may be, has a duty to convert a non-income-producing asset into an asset that is income-producing.
Well, let's say it was distributed. It had been distributed to yes. Mrs. Montgomery and her brother. Mm-hmm. And presumably, the way you were reading the trust, it would be distributed. They'd hold it as tenants in common, not as joint tenants with a common law right of survivorship. But I don't know.
Actually, the court, the trust provides the assets are to be divided equally, and it doesn't explain that. That is not an equal division of the asset.
In other words, real estate doesn't have to be owned 50%, 50%.
That's correct. Right.
But let's say it is, because maybe that's what the parents intended. So let's say it is. If they own it, let's say as tenants in common, how does Mrs. Montgomery force her brother to agree to a rental?
And then the court addressed that in the trial court. The court you always have the election to file a partition suit. Okay, if it cannot be divided in kind, the part of the property could be sold. Short and simple. In this case, we are sitting on, in terms of real estate, $1.23 million in assessed value assets that are being parked under the proverbial mattress.
In the context of this case, could the
yes,
court, trial court order a partition suit?
The court could not order a partition suit, but certainly the court could contemplate to what asset can this asset be used, devoted. In our case, there were two options. There was, well, you sell it. You don't want to sell it. For example, Ms. Montgomery testified at trial that we didn't want to sell the Sandston home, that is her parents' home across the street, because its assessed value was worth less than what they had put into it, $248,000 versus $400,000. And as to the Deltaville property, we just don't want to sell it. My point being that this trust provides that all the assets are to be divided equally. And no, the court cannot force a partition suit in this instant litigation regarding spousal support, but the court certainly can consider what is Ms. Montgomery's half of that estate, and how is that half being utilized or not?
In other words, there's an income available to the woman, but based upon her decision to forbear in an activity that she has the option to do, the court is thereby going to consider that this is indeed income to her, so therefore we're going to say that we're going to consider for purposes of spouses.
That is correct, and that coalesces exactly with the case law with respect to the party's duty to convert even a non-income-producing asset into an income-producing asset.
Let me ask you this, to follow up. If the brother doesn't want to rent it, and the court can't order a partition suit for selling purposes.
Right.
As a practical matter, and of course we haven't gotten there because the trust owns it, but if they did own it 50-50, tenants in common, isn't the fair market rental value going to be significantly below? How can it be 50% of what the fair market value would be if half of the owner doesn't even want to rent it and is not willing to put it up for rent, can't be forced to?
And that begs the question, Your Honor. Of course, the trust provides that the assets are to be divided equally.
Right.
And let's assume Mr. Michael Rosendorf objects. She has a statutory authority to, in fact, rent the property on her own over his objection. And by the way, if he doesn't want to rent it, it goes to the next issue. Okay, we can't agree on the disposition of this estate, notwithstanding our parents' instruction. Well, then we resort to a partition suit if necessary. The point being is crystallizing a monetary value to Ms. Montgomery that then can be utilized for the purpose of producing income. That's the issue.
My question is, though, you seem to be arguing that her income of that, say, Rope Yarn, which is very nice property, obviously.
Yes.
That her income from that should be 50% of the fair market rental value. Is it quite that crisply clear, though, that that's what it could bring, just because she wants to rent half of it, but he doesn't?
Well, I'm not understanding Your Honor's question, Judge Beals, that in terms of one co-landlord's apprehension or resistance to renting it, therefore lowers the fair rental value. Have I misphrased the character?
Well, I think that is getting to it, because it's not as if you can just crisply put it out there and say, okay, it'll rent for, let's just say, $3,000 a month,
right.
So therefore she'd get $1,500 a month. If there's not a desire to rent it in the first place, and you've got to overcome all of that. And
I do understand your question, but my response, Your Honor, is that just because one co-landlord in your illustration does not want to rent it does not then lead to the inference that therefore the rental value is therefore lower. And in fact, to the contrary, I think a fair inference would be that if we're going to have to rent it, then let's rent it at a premium because I don't want to rent it.
But isn't what we're really dealing with here either an inchoate or not fully developed asset?
Oh, it's a developed asset. The record establishes the value of this asset. It's not a personal injury or a contingency claim out of which we're trying to develop income that someone may get. It is a crystal clear asset in terms of assessed value, and moreover, the rental income. I don't want to elude your questions, but I have a couple more points, and I have about 1 minute left. And this coalesces this issue of inaction with Mr. Melberg's testimony. On the one hand, you have Dr. Sensabaugh, who took several propositions of why Ms. Montgomery was not working for the last 5 years, and said we can therefore eviscerate the 2011 ruling because she hasn't worked, and therefore she's put herself in a position where she's not as employable. On the other, and the court disregarded that evidence. The court found that her inaction could not be used. In fact, her own reservation of spousal support, which she requests a reservation, she points to such things as a disabling disease or a dreadful motor vehicle accident, quote unquote. Those are material issues. But for example, one son's going to West Point, or another son's having trouble, segueing to a new school. Those are not material circumstances giving rise to her continued inaction. So that you're left, Your Honor, and your judge also, you mentioned...
Mr. Harris, I'm going to give you an extra 2 minutes,
okay,
just like I did Mr. Locke.
Thank you, I appreciate it. Judge Alston, you mentioned a moment ago with Mr. Locke, as between two experts, can a court pretty much pick? And that's the court certainly has the discretion to choose between experts. Often the court finds that kind of illustration in business valuation illustrations in which capital gains rates and discount rates and capital to discount rates and whatnot are at issue. But this is not the case. We have, on the one hand, an expert whose assessment was based upon a fallacy that she should not have been working in the first place, and on the other hand, an expert who testified that the median income is $65,000, assuming that she had been working for the last 5 years, and moreover, her prior work experience before she stopped working of 10 years. What Judge Marshall did, however, Your Honor, is Judge Marshall, in fact, he didn't choose either. He became, as I phrase it in the brief, I think, he became his own expert. When I say that, I mean he picked a $5,000 number to increase to her former imputation with no evidentiary basis for it. There is nothing in the record that establishes that $5,000 is a reasonable increase in income before the prior imputation. In fact, it flies in the face of the evidence through Mr. Melberg that the starting salary of a new employee in 2016 is $49,000. With respect to the other issues in this case, in terms of Ms. Montgomery's expenses, as I showed pretty detailed in the brief, her expenses are substantially the same. If you're not talking about these rental properties that are purely speculative, these properties could be rental that are purely speculative, if you look at the investment fees, which are new, you look at her taxes on support, we're down to $1 difference between her expenses in 2010, when the case was tried, and 2016. And moreover, there are certain expenses that are increased. For example, her automobile expense for her graduated son, her health insurance figure, and finally the home repairs. She said, I've got $25,000 in home repairs, but she also testified she'd already escrowed. She'd already been saving that money, so you can't double count it. So we have in this case a clear if there's any error with respect to the rental issue, it is offset by the fact that she has at the end of the day $7,300 from a sale. And that's assuming Mr. Melberg's testimony is disregarded. If we include Mr. Melberg's testimony, she's well into the $9,000 range in terms of income from all sources. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Mr. Locke, you have your rebuttal time plus, I think, the 2 minutes I gave. Well,
thank you, Your Honor. I've made several quick points. I think the court committed error either because she didn't own it at the time, which is probably the legal answer, but even if the court were to consider she was the de facto owner, the court then made two mistakes. It didn't consider the expenses associated with generating that income. And then his argument that the court should have assumed that she would have filed a partition suit and under his argument at no cost and netted the assessed value of the property and then applied the court's rate. Well, that's not what the court did. The court didn't do that. But if the court were going to say, I'm going to assume she has the authority to file a petition suit against her brother, go against her parents' wishes that they own this property together for their family, that would have costs associated with it, and the court would have to figure out what the net result of that would be after the costs associated with that litigation if you wanted to get an asset that you applied a 2.7 rate return. That wasn't done. The court simply took the gross rental income without consideration of the expenses, and that was error. With respect to the his argument that Mr. Sensabaugh had a fallacy that she shouldn't go to work, he actually just looked at her current circumstances and looked at the actual situation, which is that she hadn't worked for 20 years, and based on that, what was her income employability at that time? And even though he indicated that her expenses were the same, her expenses are $2,000 higher just for the inherited property. Her parents gave her $817,000 of liquid assets, which produces more than enough income to support the expenses of the real estate. But just for the portion of the property that she is going to inherit,
the expenses are $2,000 higher. So if you look at her total expenses, there was a 50% increase in her expenses from 2011, and the court found there was little change in her expenses, and that was not accurate. I appreciate your attention and time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Locke. We will recounsel, and then the court is going to take a brief recess. Just to let you